Today is Tuesday, January 29th, 2019, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jim Bertel for Lori London in Washington. Coming up, the Trump administration sanctions Venezuela's state-owned oil company. We'll talk about the implications. The acting U.S. Attorney General says the Russia investigation is coming to a close.
Right now, you know, the investigation is, close to being completed, and I hope that we can get the report from Director Mueller as soon as possible.
And we'll look at growing tensions between Japan and South Korea. It's all on today's International Edition. The Trump administration is imposing sanctions on Venezuela's state-run oil company, saying it wants to preserve the assets for the Venezuelan people. In making the announcement, National Security Advisor John Bolton said Venezuelans have had enough of oppression and economic hardship caused by President Nicolas Maduro and his regime. Joining me with more on the situation with Venezuela is VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain. Cindy, explain to us what the sanctions are and what impact they'll have on a country already in economic chaos.
Well, these sanctions are mainly against Venezuela's state-owned oil company, PDVSA, as it's known. And, of course, oil is the lifeline for Venezuela. It's its main source of revenue and income. And the United States is saying that it wants to prevent Nicolas Maduro, who up to now has been the president, from, as the U.S. says, further plundering Venezuela's assets and natural resources, with, as we know, tens of thousands of people taking to the streets, calling for Maduro to step down and saying that they're hungry. Basically, they need food and they need medical care, and the conditions have really gotten desperate.
Well, let's talk about what is happening on the streets there. Juan Guaido is the interim leader, the self-proclaimed interim leader, and he has been recognized by the United States and dozens of other countries around the world. He is offering amnesty to soldiers who back democracy and reject the current Maduro government. Is this heading for a military showdown, or is this going to end up peaceful?
Well, that's a very good question, Jim, and I don't think anybody knows at this stage. But it looks to me like with this latest action, the U.S. is seeking to use economic and diplomatic pressure to more or less force the transition over to who had been the opposition leader, Guaido. So it looks like the U.S. is first trying with this oil to choke off funds from Maduro and redirect those funds over to what the U.S. and other countries, some other countries, recognize as the new government. So I think that the U.S. may be speculating that if military leaders and regular military personnel and others in Venezuela are no longer getting paid, then that could hasten the departure of Maduro.
These sanctions are not happening in a vacuum. Maduro has some very powerful allies, including Russia and China. Will they step in to support him and sort of, you know, eliminate the results of the sanctions?
Well, that is another good question. And there are reports that that Russia and Cuba both protect Venezuela's military and paramilitary forces. So we'll have to see if and when push comes to shove. What exactly, so far, you know, as I said, it's all been happening more in the diplomatic and the economic realm. But that's a very good question because, as you say, Russia and China and others are involved.
Well, from your perch at the State Department, you've had a chance to look at some of the diplomatic maneuvering firsthand. Last week, Maduro ordered U.S. diplomats out of Venezuela. Since then, he seems to have backed down, and the U.S. no longer recognizes him, so they declined to remove their key diplomats in Venezuela. Where do things stand now diplomatically, considering that and the new sanctions?
Well, that has been fascinating. We had the Venezuelan foreign minister saying today that if it was necessary, Maduro would be prepared to talk to President Donald Trump or even the devil himself. He said if it would help to create peace between the two countries. So I think that they are really feeling the pressure and signaling a willingness to talk. But those remarks came before these new devastating oil sanctions. And Venezuela has said that they have, or I should say Maduro and his people have been saying that they were meeting with a U.S. diplomat in Venezuela, and we're trying to get confirmation of that here at the State Department, but have not gotten confirmation yet.
That's VOA State Department correspondent Cindy Sain, and this is VOA's International Edition. Among the top stories in the world, Turkey's foreign minister met with a UN judicial expert investigating the murder of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. British officials are wargaming various strategies for coping with the disruption of Britain leaving the European Union without an exit deal. A top Russian diplomat is in Pakistan to discuss efforts to promote direct peace talks between the warring sides and neighboring Afghanistan. Confidential information of over 14,000 people diagnosed with HIV in Singapore has been leaked. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the voanews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists from the universities of Scotland and Kent studied and analyzed some of the world's oldest cave paintings at sites in Turkey, Spain, France, and Germany. They say their investigations reveal that rather than just being primitive depictions of humans and animals, the ancient cave art actually suggests that people from as far back as 40,000 years ago had comparatively advanced knowledge of astronomy than had been thought. The Scottish and English researchers say the animals depicted in the ancient art are actually symbolic representations of star constellations, which were used to signify dates and designate occasions such as comet strikes. The researchers who detailed their findings in a study published by the Athens Journal of History say this astronomical knowledge could have helped ancient mariners navigate the open seas, something that could have impacted migration paths of prehistoric humans. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. Special Representative for Afghan Reconciliation is urging direct talks between the Taliban and the Kabul government. Zalmay Khalizaid says Washington is committed to withdrawing foreign forces from Afghanistan to end more than 17 years of war. Reuters' Nathan Frandino reports.
After more than 17 years of war, American officials are sending some of the clearest signs yet that a U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan is in the works after peace talks yielded progress toward a deal. A senior U.S. government official told Reuters on Monday, Washington is committed to bringing U.S. troops home and leaving behind a good legacy. Those comments follow 6 days of U.S. peace talks with Afghan Taliban militants in Qatar. The official described significant progress in those talks, but said more negotiations were needed to address the withdrawal and a ceasefire. The U.S. official said there could not be a withdrawal without a ceasefire, but the Taliban want U.S. and allied troops gone first. On Monday, the New York Times reported the two sides had agreed on a framework for a deal. About 14,000 U.S. troops remain in Afghanistan as part of a NATO-led mission to train, advise, and assist the Afghan forces. But the Taliban controls nearly half the country and stages frequent attacks against the Western-backed Afghan government and its security forces. An attack in central Afghanistan a week ago killed scores of security personnel. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, in a televised address Monday, said the foreign troops would not be required forever. He also urged the Taliban to open talks with Afghan authorities, a move the militants have repeatedly rejected thus far, viewing the Kabul government as a puppet of the United States.
That's Reuters' Nathan Frandino reporting. This is VOA's International Edition. The U.S. government reopened for most federal workers Monday, who now have a 3-week respite before another possible shutdown. Joining me is VOA congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson. Catherine, have Democrats and Republicans in Congress started negotiations on a permanent spending bill?
Well, today was a little bit of a lull after the excitement of late last week when the government reopened at the last minute on Friday. The first movement that we're going to see up on Capitol Hill will be this Wednesday, when the members of the special commission will meet for the very first time to discuss what possible deal on immigration they could reach to make sure that the government does stay open past that February 15th deadline.
Well, the president is not optimistic a deal will eventually go through, giving it less than 50-50 odds. What happens if a deal is not reached by February 15th?
Well, he said it himself in the Rose Garden on Friday when he announced that he was endorsing that three-week short-term spending deal. He said that he still had that option of declaring a national emergency to allocate the funds for building a border wall. He said that if Democrats and Republicans don't reach an agreement, then that's certainly still an option on the table for him.
Is citizenship for so-called dreamers, children brought to the U.S. illegally, is that still on the table?
That's certainly going to be in the mix up here on Capitol Hill. That's something that we've struggled to address for 2 years now. Had votes come up, had them fail. It's something that really, I think, a lot of members of parties on both sides of the aisle can come behind to get a solution for these children, some of whom are now adults, to get them resolved their status here in the United States. But it's anybody's guess whether they can actually hammer out the details. There's a lot of debate over whether they would be granted temporary status, permanent status. That's where we're really going to be seeing the haggling in the next few weeks.
The thing we've heard talked about the most during the shutdown is money for the border wall. President Trump is insisting on over $5 billion for it. The Democrats are saying there will be no money for a border wall. Are you hearing anything from your sources regarding a compromise on that?
Well, what was really interesting to me about President Trump's statements on Friday afternoon was the way phrased what he wanted to see in a border wall. He used the phrase smart wall, which is one of the first times, if not the first time, I've heard him use that phrase. It's a phrase that some Republicans up here on Capitol Hill use as well. Rep. Will Hurd, who has the most miles of U.S.-Mexico border of any congressional district, he knows the border better than anyone. He says that we need a smart wall on the border. And what that would look like is more Border Patrol agents, more manpower on the border, as well as more technology. A lot of people are saying, you know, the wall is a little bit old-fashioned. We should be using drones. We should be using electronic sensors. I think if Democrats and Republicans can find a compromise, it'll look like a mix of approaches to the border.
The shutdown itself, which lasted 35 days, is estimated to have cost the U.S. economy anywhere from $6 to $8 billion. Some members of Congress are talking openly about providing language in the final bill that will prevent future shutdowns. Is this likely to have bipartisan support?
Well, after this record-breaking 35-day shutdown, which is ultimately turned out to be the longest shutdown in U.S. history, I think there is some movement to say, you know, look, this didn't work out in the end. Negotiating on the backs of government workers really didn't end up benefiting anybody. And it created a lot of bad press, a lot of bad feeling in the end. People who were not able to make their rent payments, that type of thing. That could get some leverage, but, you know, up here on Capitol Hill, sooner or later, everything does get political, and it really will have to wait and see how that pans out.
VOA Congressional Correspondent Catherine Gibson, thank you for joining us. One of the casualties of the partial government shutdown was the annual State of the Union address by the president. With the government now reopened, the address has been rescheduled for early next week. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who rescinded a formal invitation to the president last week because of the government shutdown, has now invited President Trump to address a joint session of Congress next Tuesday, February 5th. President Trump has responded. His letter says that it is his great honor to accept her invitation, saying we have a great story to tell. Although the president agreed to reopen the government for now, there could be another shutdown on the horizon over border wall funding. Jackie Quinn, Washington.
On Monday, Acting U.S. Attorney General Matthew Whitaker announced the special counsel's Russia investigation is close to wrapping up.
Right now, you know, the investigation is, close to being completed, and I hope that we can get the report from Director Mueller as soon as possible.
But there's no guarantee the report will be made public. Legislation has been introduced in the Senate to change that and require public disclosure of the findings. AP's Mike Gracia reports.
Republican Chuck Grassley of Iowa and Connecticut Democrat Richard Blumenthal introduced legislation in the Senate Monday that would require public disclosure of findings in Special Counsel Robert Mueller's Russia probe. The report would be sent to Congress and to the public. Under the legislation, a report would also be required within 2 weeks in the event of the special counsel being fired, transferred, or resigning. Last year, Grassley and Blumenthal supported legislation to protect Mueller's job, but Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell declined to hold a vote on the bill, saying it was unnecessary. Mike Gracia, Washington.
The Justice Department unsealed criminal charges against Chinese tech giant Huawei, two of its subsidiaries, and a top executive. AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Huawei is the world's biggest supplier of network gear used by phone and internet companies. Acting Attorney General Matthew Whitaker says the accusations include misleading banks about the company's dealings with Iran.
These alleged false claims led banks to do business with the company and therefore to unknowingly violate our laws.
Huawei's chief financial officer, Meng-Wan Zhou, is also facing charges. She was arrested last month in Canada. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross says the U.S. is sending a strong message.
Too many companies pursue profits by whatever means necessary. Lying, cheating, and stealing are not suitable corporate growth strategies.
Huawei is also accused of stealing trade secrets. Ed Donahue, Washington.
And this is VOA's International Edition. The United Nations envoy for Yemen is urging the warring parties to withdraw their troops from the port city of Hodeidah quickly. And international aid agencies say the conditions for thousands of starving people are deteriorating fast. Reuters' Gracie Jerome reports.
Warring troops in Yemen are falling further behind on their promise to withdraw from the lifeline port of Hodeidah, as aid agencies warn the world's worst humanitarian crisis is deteriorating. Hodeidah is the main entry point for aid and commercial imports. It's controlled by the Iran-aligned Houthis, while soldiers of a Saudi-led coalition are massed on its outskirts. The two sides disagree about who should control the port, and neither has implemented a troop withdrawal that was meant to take place on January the 7th. The United Nations is now urging both sides to stick to the agreement, while admitting that the deadline had been ambitious, but that to break it would be to fail the people of Yemen, where 14 million people are on the brink of famine. 12 uneducated children, no food, no water, no clothes, and no proper hygiene like normal people. We don't have anything but a gracious God. The warning comes as more than a dozen aid agencies met in London to talk about action. Their message was clear. The millions of suffering Yemenis need more than food.
I think we need to be very clear that we need a political solution to this conflict.
The truce that should have seen troops pull out was agreed in Stockholm in December. It was the first political breakthrough in a four-year stalemate between Saudi-backed government forces and their Houthi opposition. Half of Yemen's population is totally dependent on external aid for survival, much of which comes through Hodeidah.
That's Reuters' Gracie Jerome reporting. And you're listening to International Edition from VOA.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. There, the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports.
This is VOA's International Edition. The government in Seoul, South Korea, has accused Japan of repeated low-altitude, provocative flights over its naval vessels. It's an ongoing public row that's lasted for more than a month, and something the Japanese government denies has taken place. To explain what's going on between two of America's allies in the Far East, VOA Seoul correspondent Steve Miller joins us. Steve, can you give us a little background on what started the dispute between the two countries?
Sure, Jim. So basically, in late December, some South Korean naval vessels were responding to a distress signal sent by a North Korean fishing vessel that had run into some problems and was drifting into international waters between the two countries. Now, Japan claims that a maritime self-defense force P-1 aircraft was targeted with fire control radar from a South Korean warship and felt threatened because of that action. South Korea said that their vessels actually felt threatened because of the track and low altitude of the Japanese aircraft. It's important to note that fire control radar is the first step that a ship takes to target an advancing threat before it could presumably fire missiles to destroy a potentially hostile craft. Now, since this event took place in late December, South Korea has also reported at least three other incidents where it says Japanese aircraft approach its vessels at a height of about 60 to 70 meters. Now, Seoul has characterized these flights as provocative acts, since the international norm when an aircraft is approaching another naval vessel is to fly at about 150 meters. Now, these kinds of incidents do take place under somewhat routine basis between different militaries, but they're usually handled behind the scenes rather than in public. Recently, I spoke to Grant Newsham, who is a senior research fellow at the Japan Forum for Strategic Studies in Tokyo, and he told me the reason he thinks that this issue has been made public is because he senses a sense of frustration by Japan's senior leadership over recent court decisions in South Korea that have ordered Japanese firms to pay compensation to forced laborers in World War II, and that's something that Tokyo considers resolved by the 1965 bilateral agreement between the two countries.
As you pointed out, these discussions usually happen behind the scenes. What discussions have taken place between the two sides?
Well, last week, South Korean Foreign Minister Kang Kyung-hwa met with Japanese Foreign Minister Taro Kono on the sidelines of the World Economic Forum annual meeting that took place in Davos, Switzerland, to address this specific issue. Now, Japan had hoped that the meeting would be used to seek out a remedy to end the rift, but Kang was quoted as saying right before the meeting got underway that the incidents were very annoying and regrettable. Kono then responded by saying Seoul's announcement of additional alleged low-altitude flights was regrettable and denied that the Japanese planes had actually conducted low-altitude flights, that they had actually flown at the proper 150-meter ceiling. Now, the head of South Korea's Joint Chiefs of Staff's operational headquarters also said that South Korea would take appropriate action in line with its military code of conduct if these kinds of flights persisted, but then didn't give any details as to what they would do.
There's no reason to think that these are anything more than intimidation methods. There's no chance that there'll be shots fired between the two sides.
Well, that's something that's very interesting because we're already starting to see a little fallout between the two militaries, which typically have had really good relations for decades. Now, recently, Japanese local media reported that Tokyo is canceling a Japanese destroyer's call to the port city of Busan here in South Korea over the row. However, Seoul says it hasn't received any official updates from Japan about that vessel canceling its participation in some joint exercises that were scheduled. In addition, the commander of the South Korean Navy's First Fleet has called off a planned trip to Tokyo next month. But analysts I actually spoke to presume that, you know, this row will end relatively quickly. But both Newsham and Shim Jae-ok, who is a professor at the Department of Aviation at Seihan University in South Korea, who is also a former 30-year naval pilot in South Korea, said that if Japan and South Korea continue on their current trend without remedying the situation, it actually could result in some sort of conflict between the two, as unlikely as that sounds. But overall, all the analysts tell me that they do expect this to pass, but there is a very unlikely chance that because of underlying tensions, there could be some minor skirmishes between the two. But what they also tell me is that this is really a disagreement between the upper echelons in the two governments rather than at the lower military-to-military level.
And that is Steve Miller joining us from Seoul, South Korea. Well, we're hearing a lot lately about blockchain technology. Blockchain technology is a high-tech way to securely manage and protect data, and is probably best known as the driver of the cryptocurrency Bitcoin. Now, a U.S. coffee importer is using it to improve the lives of coffee farmers and some of the poorest communities in Central America. VOA's Faith Lapidus reports.
Ivan Herrera grows coffee in the hills above Santa Rosa de Lima, 40 kilometers outside Guatemala's capital city. She's proud of her crop.
We're going to pick a great coffee. That's what we've been working towards, and this year we're seeing the result of 2 years' hard work.
Like most of the world's coffee farmers, Herrera used to sell her product on the International Coffee Futures Market, where buyers agree to purchase the beans at a predetermined price for a future delivery date. That depresses prices and leaves them vulnerable to currency fluctuation. But now, Herrera sells directly to an independent coffee roaster in the United States and gets a premium price. The system is the brainchild of Paul Tupper and his brother Scott, who harnessed a successful blockchain technology business in Seattle to tackle the issue of environmental sustainability in the developing world.
Anyone who's a fan of coffee and many other goods has seen the proliferation of standards and certifications that are out on the market, and it can be confusing for a consumer. Blockchain can lay on top of all of this as a way to verify what's actually going on financially and socially.
Blockchain technology creates a ledger to record, manage, and confirm transactions transparently and verifiably by all stakeholders, such as the coffee grower, the importer, and the roaster. The brothers' company, Onda Origins, believes that enough consumers will care about where their coffee comes from to pay for quality roasted small batch beans, so it can pay its growers a premium price that exceeds even standard fair trade coffee. The guaranteed higher prices will allow growers like Yvonne Herrera to not only invest in and protect her land, but also pay better wages to her workers, raising the standard of living across her community. Faith Lapidus, VOA News.
Hollywood celebrated the best of film and television at the SAG Awards this week. Reuters' Eve Johnson reports.
Superhero smash hit Black Panther scooped up top prize at the Screen Actors Guild Awards Sunday. The SAG Awards are seen as a preview for next month's Academy Awards, meaning Black Panther's win for Best Movie Ensemble makes it a real contender for an Oscar. Star Chadwick Boseman accepted the award.
We knew not that we would be around during award season or that it would make $1 billion, but we knew that we had something special that we wanted to give the world, that we could be full human beings in the roles that we were playing.
But the night delivered another snub for critic favorite A Star Is Born. Bradley Cooper and Lady Gaga's musical also failed to take home the top prize at the Golden Globes. Best Film Actress Award went to Glenn Close for her role as devoted spouse in The Wife. And Rami Malek won the trophy for Best Film Actor for playing Queen frontman Freddie Mercury in Bohemian Rhapsody.
I thank Queen and Freddie Mercury. I get some power from him that is about stepping up and living your best life.
On the TV side, Amazon series The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel swept the comedy honors, winning Best Ensemble plus Best Actor and Actress for Tony Shalhoub and Rachel Brosnahan.
To be able to count you all in this room as my peers, let alone to stand up on this stage, is beyond my wildest dreams.
NBC's This Is Us won top television drama. And a Lifetime Achievement Award went to Alan Alda, best known for his role as Army Doctor Hawkeye on the TV show MASH.
And when a culture is divided so sharply, actors can help at least a little just by doing what we do.
This year's SAG Awards largely steered clear of politics, except for Patricia Arquette. While accepting her Best TV Actress Award, she gave a shout-out to Special Counsel Robert Mueller for, quote, making sure we have sovereignty in the United States of America.
And that's Reuters' Eve Johnson reporting from Hollywood. I want to thank you for listening to International Edition, and my thanks to our studio team, Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Jimmy Cook. I'm Jim Bertel in Washington. Thanks for listening.
We'll be right back.
This is VOA News. I'm